want you to kind of sag here and then talk a little bit about a couple other places. I spent a long time in the Army. I'm a slow learner, y'all. I was within 5 years of my retirement before I started getting a real clear picture of what it was I'd been involved in for 2 decades. And I think it's important for us to understand, you know, to make sure that we're fueled by our moral outrage, but it's also important for us to understand how this system works so that we can understand better how to go disrupt it. And I want to talk a little bit about that too, because I think the people in this room right now have a special role in that kind of political disruption. It's really necessary right now, because we're living under a regime right now that's on an incredibly dangerous and destructive path, not just for people in other parts of the world, but for us and for the planet in general. This is one of the most frightening administrations we've seen in a long time, and that's saying something at the end of a century of arch criminals who run this country. So anyway, I was in the Army for quite a while, starting in Vietnam and ending my career. My last deployment was into Haiti in 1994, about which I've written a book that Dennis just came up and said, I've got to flog these books and get as many of you as I can to buy some so I can pay for my plane ticket out here. So you'll see those things laying around. I worked in 8 conflict areas. But I did not always work as a direct combatant, and that's an important thing to understand, is that the United States has sort of 2 different ways of employing the military, and one of those ways is through the community that I was part of for a long time, which is Special Operations Community. Our job was not so much to go over there and act as combatants, but to do the type of things that some of the Vietnam veterans here will remember back when the MAG was organized, and you working in an advisory and assistance role to try to push indigenous people out there to do all the things that we really don't want to, you know, when we don't want to get our hands wet. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the role of special forces and the embassies as extensions of the executive branch, and about the Rumsfeld Doctrine as it's currently being played out, so that we can get a little clearer picture of what's going on right now in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Colombia, and some other places. I will say, talking about the paramilitaries in Colombia, I was in Colombia in 1992 as an advisor at Tolimada Air Base. I worked training the 1st and 2nd Colombian Special Forces Battalions down there in night operations as part of an ongoing program. And what's interesting is we were giving aid to them then, too. We would give the Colombian government money, which they in turn would pay back to the U.S. military to send advisors down there. So we paid ourselves via this circuitous, right? You got to follow the money sometimes to figure out how this stuff works. To come back in there and then give them training. So then we buy all our gear with the money we'd given to the Colombians, and the Colombians gave back to us. 1991, a year before I went down there, there's a guy named Carlos Castaño. He's a pretty nasty character, and he was for years and years, until just here very recently, sort of in charge of this umbrella organization, the AUC. Of all the paramilitaries in the country. In 1991, the Department of Defense, the Central Intelligence Agency, assisted the Colombian government in integrating the staffs. Veterans will understand this. They integrated the staffs of the AUC with the Colombian military. So people that haven't been in the military don't understand what the integration of a staff means. What integration of a staff means is you've got the same command structure. It's the same organization. So the notion that we're going to get the Colombian military to turn around and attack the AUC is like going into an infantry company, the United States Army, and say that you're going to have 1st Platoon attack 2nd Platoon. They're units in the same organization. And that's still true. Those staffs were coordinated. What they've done is developed an organization now where they can push the Colombian military out front into higher visibility positions and have them observe just cursorily observe human rights norms that are established through international law, and allow the AUC to go out there and do all their wet work for them. And oh, by the way, we also have people like DynCorp and these other mercenary organizations that are now contracted to the Pentagon, to the Department of Defense, to go out and do the spraying and also provide close air support. Don't think they're not out there doing that. They're providing close air support for Colombian troops when they go up against the FARC and the ELN. These people are mercenary organizations. They're hired by the Pentagon. They're paid with the money that you and I give them in our taxes, but they are not subject to congressional oversight the same way that the U.S. military is. So they found all sorts of ways to sort of go around things, you know. And what DynCorp does now is they spray these micro-herbicides all over the ground. They don't just kill coca. They kill all the crops because it's a depopulation program. You see, they heard the old maxim from Mao that the people are the sea and the gorilla are the fish. Well, Castaño said, well, we'll just drain the ocean then. You know, so what they're doing is pushing entire peoples off their land for the purpose of gaining strategic access to it, both for economic development and because there is a fair amount of petroleum in Colombia right now. Petroleum is a very strategic mineral that's now peaked worldwide and going to become more and more rarefied as time goes on. And so gaining control of the world's energy resources, as we are trying to do now in Iraq, is going to be key to sort of moving forward in a larger geostrategic agenda the bosses in this particular country. I worked in as an advisor in various times in Panama, Honduras, Guatemala, El Salvador, Peru, Colombia, Venezuela, and then I went to Haiti in a sort of a different role. In fact, in Haiti, we developed some of the doctrines that are now being employed in Afghanistan, for instance, for the Special Forces community. And in El Salvador and Guatemala, I worked directly under the supervision. You're always under the supervision of the MIL group at the U.S. Embassy, but it's important to understand the structure. I worked directly under the supervision of the U.S. Embassy when I was in Guatemala and El Salvador. So I really got, this sort of made my military career unique because most military people don't really get that snapshot. They don't get to get inside that embassy and see how this direct representative of the U.S. executive branch is operating inside the country. And what they got inside there, they got something called a country team. You know, they got all these sections, and each section has a head, and each of these heads get together as a country team every day and have a briefing. It's a staff briefing. You know, it's a staff meeting. And you've got the old man as a rule, because men still tend to dominate the Foreign Service. You've got the ambassador, and you'll have his or her deputy in there. You'll have the econ section, you'll have the MIL group, you have the security section, you have the consular section, you have the political section. Okay, just sort of get your head around that for a second. I'll go through and sort of describe what these are. The econ section is responsible. The guy in charge of the econ section, his job is to set up a relationship and maintain a relationship with the National Chamber of Commerce. I'm not joking about it. That's his job. Okay. Then there's the MIL group. That's the military group. The MIL group links up with the staff of the host country military. And you have the consular section that processes visas and passports and all that kind of stuff. You got the security section that runs the Marine security guards, runs the bodyguard details for the old man, and conducts all the investigation of all the indigenous folks they hire to come and work as office workers and guards and whatnot at the embassy. And then you've got the political section, which is a euphemism. The political section is the Central Intelligence Agency. Okay? And all these people get together every day, and what was surprising to me was who was setting the agenda. You think, well, would it be the security section? Not the security section. Would it be the political section? This is a political entity. You think the political section was setting the agenda. But really, 9 times out of 10, the agenda was being set by the econ section. And this is where I had that moment where I said, aha, you know, this is about money. So that was my first experience, just sort of seeing how this thing runs, how the Foreign Service actually runs, how they build the direct relationships with their counterparts inside the host country. And then to understand, it's also important to understand that they work for the President of the United States via the Secretary of State. Okay, so when you've got a guy, you know, an intellectual mediocrity like George W. Bush, he decides who's going to represent the United States at these U.S. embassies, and whoever is working for him in the State Department is really carrying out those directives. So every U.S. embassy in the world right now is really doing what George Bush wants them to do, which means they're doing what Firth and Pearl and Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz and all these other people want them to do, because that's the clique that's in power right now. That's a dangerous clique that's in power right now. And when you get into a place where there's the military gains ascendancy because they had to resort to military operation, then you get into a situation like Colombia or like Haiti. And there's sort of two parts to how you do that. I'm being very extemporaneous, and I came in on a red eye, so if I'm stuttering, I apologize. But there's two parts to making sure this stuff works. One part is to make sure that the embassy does its job with all its sort of satellite agencies, and I'll talk about them in a minute. The other thing is they got to get us to acquiesce to this stuff. You know, they have to. We don't have to support it. In fact, the majority of the people in the United States don't support any of this stuff because they don't even understand what's going on. You know, what they got to do is come up with some sort of an official story that's plausible enough to get us to turn our backs on it and just acquiesce. So we'll continue to pay our taxes and, you know, do all the stuff we've got to do, give them political support, you know, and stay quiet. You know, I've been here also to support the troops. You know what support the troops means? It means shut up. You know, they're telling us to shut up. You know, that's what support the troops. Man, my son's fixing to get on a plane tomorrow to go to Baghdad Airport. I'm not going to shut up. I am supporting, you know. So, but that's what they need, is they need our acquiescence. And to get that, they've got to come up with some sort of an official story. Official narratives in every single case only coincide with the truth incidentally. sometimes they coincide with the truth if that works. But I mean, really, the purpose of the official narratives is to get us to say, okay, that's cool, we'll do it that way. And the official narrative, when I came of age, you know, and some of you look like you came of age even a little bit before I did, you know, I'll be honest with you, was the world communist conspiracy. We had to go out there and stop this world communist conspiracy, you know, because if we didn't stop them and wait, they were going to be in Raleigh, you know what I mean? I mean, that was the story, and a lot of us believe that. Because they had us, you know, whipped up into a state of paranoia. Duh. I mean, you know, that's pretty familiar these days. And so that worked. Well, that didn't work. Now they've got this other thing. They talk about drugs. You know, when I was in Colombia, I was briefed by the PAO. That's Public Affairs Officer. For those of you who hadn't been in the military, I think most of you have. But the PAO told us when we went through Fort Clayton, Panama, to process in the theater, here's the official story. This is the official story. You are down there to provide counter-narcotics assistance. I'd never seen a picture of a drug lab. Wouldn't know a drug lab if it bit me in the ass. I don't know anything about drugs. I'm not a cop. I was never a cop. You know? At the same time, we got the briefing, the PAO said you're supposed to go down there and assist in the counter-narcotics efforts. They also told us what our real mission was, and that was to develop a counterinsurgency capability. Our job was to go down there and beef these people up, partly because their officer corps was one of the most corrupt and venal institutions that I've ever seen anywhere. And that's saying something, because I've been to Guatemala and El Salvador, too, you know, where thief is a synonym for an officer in the military, you know. But that was our job, was to beef up their capability to go out there and not just beset these guerrillas, but to beset all these people that were identified as guerrillas, the sea. That they had to drain, you know. So they had to have the official story. It was drugs. Well, now the drug thing is wearing off, and in fact, it was sort of losing traction because even members of the dominant class in the United States started to question this whole drug war because it seemed like we were losing it. And the harder we fought it, the more we lost it. I mean, what happens to a commodity whenever you start making it harder to get it? You run the price up and the profit margins go, what kind of a war is that where every time you win a battle, you empower your enemy? It don't make any sense, right? You know? But, I mean, that wasn't why we were there, and we knew that. You know, that's the interesting thing is a lot of times soldiers, especially folks in special operations, know that better than most of the public because we're the ones who are required to understand the lie and live with the lie. You know? It also means that we're exposed to a lot of subversive influences, and I'll talk about that in a little bit too. I was talking to Tim earlier about that. Now, you know, in July 2001, the Pakistani embassy was noted. This is July 2001. The Pakistani embassy had already been notified that there was probably going to be a military incursion into Afghanistan sometime around October. This is well before September 11th. Okay. Then, all of a sudden, September 11th, boom, you know, everything blows out. Now, I'm not buying any conspiracy theories and claiming Bush presidency said it. I don't believe that, you know. But I really do believe that inside that administration, when they got out of the public eye, where they go out there and wring their hands and, you know, pretend how sorry they were and all this stuff, they were back there going, thank you, God. You know, because this was a gift from Santa Claus to this administration. This allowed them to step on the accelerator for this very creepy, very dangerous agenda that they're involved in moving forward on right now. Back to the embassies, and again, I apologize for sort of rambling all over the place. There's some other stuff about embassies that people need to understand. This is something that I picked up on when I was in Haiti. And one of the things I learned in Haiti is something that some of these lads and lasses are learning about right now in Iraq and Afghanistan. What's the role of an occupier? Because the role of an occupier is a little bit different than the role of a combatant. Sometimes it means you're a combatant too, you know, as it does around Fallujah and places like that right now. But it also means, again, that you're directly exposed, I mean, glaringly exposed to the hypocrisy of these official narratives. And one of the things that I learned about, you know, well, let's talk about Haiti. Haiti, we didn't have any drugs to go after. And there were no communists in Haiti. And, gosh, let's see, there were no terrorists in Haiti. And there's no oil in Haiti. What in the world were we going to Haiti for? You know, what was all that about? We already had, you know, we already had this brutal outfit installed. They'd already overthrown Aristide with the assistance of the U.S. Embassy, and I can talk about that in a minute. 1991, now all of a sudden in 1994, we got to throw all these guys out. Because sometimes our creatures begin to develop an independent streak, like the Noriegas and whatnot, or the Bin Ladens, and they have to be demobilized. And sometimes they're so awful that they create a form of popular democracy that says we're not going to be contained by an electoral process and we're going to take matters into our own hand. And that's what was going on in Haiti around 1993. They'd already thrown Baby Doc out just 5 years before, you know, and threw him out by force, ran him out of town on a rail, flew out on a C-130 so he could go live on the left bank in Paris, you know, in his golden parachute. But he had to get out of town quick. And I love Haiti, so sometimes whenever I start talking about it, I get, you know, sort of maudlin. But Haitian people were the second successful revolution in this hemisphere. In 1804, they won their independence from a slave rebellion. First independent black nation in the world is Haiti. These people have, and everyone in Haiti, down to little bitty children, know about this. You know, they know that their situation is punishment. It's punishment for being a black nation that won its independence from a slave rebellion, because that reverberated throughout the whole continent. In fact, Bolivar was very interested in the history of Toussaint Louverture. You know, and these people were on the upswing again. That's what the Cedras administration that we had to throw out in 1994 and replace Aristide with, or replace him with Aristide after we had, you know, maneuvered behind the scenes. Not we. It wasn't us that did it. It was them, you know, people up in D.C., people with the State Department, people with the military. I'm sorry, I won't get off on too much of a tangent. Hey, but something's going on in Haiti right now that's not being done with military intervention. In fact, there was so much resistance that we pulled our troops back out of Haiti again. Did you know that? Popular resistance removed the U.S. military from Haiti. Slowly, but it happened over time. I've been back there 9 times since I was down there during the intervention. But it was like, they were just not going along. Haitian people are rebellious, y'all. You know? And that's what was about to happen. We didn't go back in there to remove Cedras. We went in there to remove Sabres and Francois because they were becoming a catalyst for another potential revolution that had nothing to do with oil. It had to do with geopolitics, because Haiti's right there. If Haiti does it again and gets away with it, there's people thinking about this in Puerto Rico, in Jamaica. You know, it's right there. They're thinking about it in Venezuela now. You know, you can't allow an example like that, like Nicaragua. You can't allow an example like that to exist in the region. Now, one of the things that they do through the embassy is they've got some other agencies in there, United States Agency for International Development, the National Endowment for Democracy, and in this political section. And the USAID does really neat things. They go out and build wells. They come up with, classrooms for children, all sorts of little tiny projects on their face seem to be very beneficial. But what they do is they bring money in and they buy off the cream of that nation's indigenous intelligentsia and remove them from the larger political equation. It's a way to co-opt them. You know, that's what they do. That's the USAID. And the USAID takes its instructions from the political section, which is the Central Intelligence Agency. They prioritize where they need to go and what projects they need to develop in order to bleed off these people who can act as potentially subversive leadership. And the other thing, this is, and I'll just close with this because I don't want to monopolize the title here. If there's any one agency that everyone should study in order to understand U.S. foreign policy as well as it can be understood, read up on the National Endowment for Democracy. The National Endowment for Democracy is a front organization. It's a front foundation through which we funnel money to determine the outcomes in advance of other people's elections. We funnel money into political organizations. The NED was people that funnel money into the anti-Chavez so-called strikes in Venezuela. They were the people that are still involved with trying to bring down the Haitian government because they feel like the wrong people are in charge there. So if you don't learn anything else from here, go back, do a web search, go down to the library and learn what you can about the National Endowment for Democracy, because that's really where the rubber meets the road. You know, the people like us, you know, people like what I used to be, we get called in when that process fails. When that process fails, then we got to resort to the gun. You know, and what they really want is they want this facade of democracy. And the facade of democracy is elections. Because you can go back afterwards. No matter how much you manipulate that process, like they did with UNO and Nicaragua and other places, no matter how much you manipulate that process, once you have the elections and you get the right people to come in and genuflect over it and say, we were observers and it was a fair election, nobody's talking about how those particular candidates were selected. It's kind of like we have here. Yeah. You know? Yeah. So there's, yeah, and I'm sorry for my lack of coherence, but I'm just going to throw some of that stuff out there and again say that, you know, again, our moral outrage is great gasoline, but knowledge about how this stuff works is a steering wheel. So if we're going to make this thing go, you know, we also have to understand our enemy right now. And I want to make sure that I cede the floor to this gentleman over right here. And thanks for your attention.